All right. And welcome, everyone, to a very special episode of Podcast Them Softly. This is Nick, and of course, as always, I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, bud?
Hello.
I know tonight we're really excited. We've got a very special guest, David Mickey Evans, the writer, director, and the narrator's voice of the heartwarming classic baseball movie The Sandlot, is here for a chat. He's also the writer producer of the cult family classic Radio Flyer. So I contributed to the Beethoven family movie series and wrote and directed and narrated The Sandlot 2. His recent novel, The King of Pacoima, is a fascinating and rather heart-wrenching expansion on the Radio Flyer universe that he created. It really hits a lot of intense notes of emotional and personal reflection. I highly recommend people check it out. Again, The King of Pacoima. And with Radio Flyer and The Sandlot, David really was able to combine a unique sense of childhood cinematic magic and with real-world trauma, like really bringing movies back to like the nitty-gritty, but also paying attention to the family dynamics that makes those movies so important. Sort of bringing it back to like that 60s era of Truffaut and, you know, kind of ditching the cliches that the 80s movies, you know, sort of brought around. It's done a lot of widely interesting uncredited rewrites on an eclectic mix of films, which is something that Frank and I are always very extremely interested in knowing all about. And he's a true movie lover. He's a huge baseball fan. So we're obviously going to get a chance to talk about some of our favorite baseball movies. So it's an honor to have you on the show, David. Thanks a lot for coming on.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you guys very, very much for having me. I'm very grateful. Thanks.
Yeah, this is rather surreal. I speak for Nick and myself here, because you know, the Sandlot was one of those films that was so ingrained in my childhood. It was like the Neverending Story, the Ewok movies, and the Sandlot was just like on a revolving loop when I was growing up, and those were like my favorite childhood films that have maintained longevity into my adulthood. So thank you again so very much for coming on.
Oh my gosh, are you kidding me? Listen, it never ceases to amaze me the power that the Sandlot has. I mean, nobody knows, you know, I'm not some actor or a person that people would know my face or anything like that. And when I narrated the Sandlot, it was sort of by accident. I'll tell you that story as we get into this stuff, but I will tell you one thing. I was coming back cross country from a picture I did in 2000 and, I think it was five, no, maybe 2006, from Iowa back to Los Angeles, where I lived at the time. And I had two of my kids with me, and they were probably 10 and 8 at the time. And we, you know, we would stop at every sort of Waffle House and, you know, Starbucks to get hot chocolate, coffee for dad and all that. And in the middle of nowhere in Missouri, we go in right off the interstate. There's a Starbucks or this or that and some sort of, you know, mall in construction. Otherwise, there's nothing there. It's probably, you know, 8 in the morning, and we get out of the RV and we go into the place, and there's this young lady there who's a barista or whatever. Can I take your order? And sorry, like two hot chocolates and a coffee or whatever. And then then time stopped. And this young lady starts staring at me. And I'm looking around like, is there a guy coming in the door with a gun that I don't know about? And I'm looking at her and she says, you're that guy. I said, sweetheart, I don't know what you're talking about. She goes, you're the guy. That's your voice. You're the Sandlot guy. Out of nowhere. Okay?
Wow.
And I mean, I had known that it was a big deal before that, but that brought it home to me cataclysmically. It was like, oh, wow. You know, I don't know. It gave me both. I was really, really grateful for it and stuff, but it also gave me a really new, sharp understanding of how important that little movie is to so many people, you know?
For sure. I mean, I got a million questions for you about it, but the one that I've been dying to ask you is, how does it feel to have created something that's so important to so many people?
Oh, that is a really good question. And how does it feel? I don't know. Look, it feels like an enormous responsibility. It feels spectacular. It feels I feel in, I guess the best way I can put it is that there's just this constant and continual state of deep gratitude that, well, that people liked it. Because if they don't like it, then, I mean, what does it mean? It ends up sort of meaning nothing except anybody than me. And it, you know, that little sort of anecdote that I told you, that's one, and there's many, 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 many hundreds, probably thousands that I could tell you. But one that I'll tell you about, in 2013, we went, my personal chief of security, Maverick, my German Shepherd, and who was my fiance at the time, we went on tour in 2013 for the 20th anniversary of The Sandlot. We went all over the United States. We drove 33,000 miles in 8 months. We went it was brutal, but it was so fun. And we went to like 26 major and minor league baseball parks all over the United States. I mean, Dodger Stadium, you know, St. Louis, Minneapolis, Newark. We went everywhere. And there was a double-A or a triple-A park in Arkansas that we played. And we sold out almost everywhere we went. Sometimes there'd be a day game, and then, you know, the fans would stay to watch the movie on the Jumbotron, or if they didn't have a Jumbotron, you know, we'd use one of those 120-foot blow-up screens in the outfield and all that. But this little double or triple-A park in Arkansas, I would, you know, stand behind a thing and sign autographs and all that. I probably signed somewhere, I never really counted, but something on the order of 50 or 75,000 autographs in that time. Met hundreds of thousands of fans. And this older gentleman came up to me at that place that we played, and he had something like 12 DVDs of The Sandlot. And he must have been, I don't know, in his late 70s. Big guy, big bear of a guy. He said, "Can you please sign this one for me?" I said, "Yes, sir. What's your name?" "Can you sign this one for my wife?" "Yes, sir." "Can you sign these three for my children?" "Yes, sir." "Can you sign these for my grandchildren? And these last four are for my great-grandchildren." So in one man coming up there, there were, what, four generations since 1992 of fans to whom The Sandlot meant like everything, you know?
And when you were just – that's unbelievable. I mean,
to this day, I can't believe it.
And to second what Frank was saying, I mean – there was a short list of movies for me growing up. You know, The Sandlot was an interesting movie for me because I came to that film as a young teen, and it hit me in a way that was probably different than it hit some kids when they saw it if they were 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. You know, I was 12, 13 when it came out, and I was in the heat of playing Little League Baseball. So it was a big movie for me in terms of being able to relate to it on a personal level in that sense. And I've always found the film to be so, so well crafted in terms of how you were able to take childhood innocence, that great feeling of what it was like to be out playing in the summer with your friends, baseball, clear love for baseball, and wrap it up into this movie that, you know, it works for kids, it works for adults. You go back and you watch some of these movies, you know, when you were a kid, and yeah, they have nostalgia, they have that value to it, but you go back and you watch some of them and they're not great. And you can now, when you've watched, you know, a couple thousand movies, and you know, you've got that sort of under your belt, you can distinguish between, you know, what made you happy as a little kid and now what's truly great and lasting cinema. And the thing is that this movie is that it's a film that has stood the test of time. And it stood, you know, the changing of the attitudes in Hollywood and people. You know, in my written piece, I mentioned that, you know, in some sort of movie, you know, movie land, movie, you know, out there, it's playing on a double bill with something like, you know, Matinee. It's the kind of film that we don't see anymore. You don't get a chance to see these kinds of films anymore. Did you have any sense when you were making it that it was going to be as special as it ended up being? I mean, did you, you know, when it was going on, how did you feel during production?
Well, during production, I mean, there's really no way to ever know. I mean, if you could, you know, I'd bottle that stuff and sell it and quit the movie industry, you know, and I'd be a quadrillionaire. There's really no way to know whether people are going to like it or not. The only thing you've got going for you, I mean, let's start, you know, as a writer, you know, I call up a blank page. It used to be on a typewriter. Yes, I started in the era of the typewriter and then moved to the word processing typewriter. And, you know, but essentially the blank page is the blank page. We play God. That's what we do. We play God. And I take that responsibility incredibly seriously. And so when I started to write this thing, it was all memory, all things that happened to me, you know, trying to dramatize things happening to me. You know, basically the idea was I was stuck on the 405 freeway in Los Angeles coming north. I had about, I don't know what, 21 miles to go. It took, you know, something on the order of 4 hours. And I was really, really, really angry. And, you know, I think I was 27 at the time. And my mind started wandering to all of those SOBs that beat me and my little brother up when we were little kids in the northeastern San Fernando Valley, you know, in the early 70s. And it occurred to me then that, you know, I was obsessing about this and it was kind of messing up my adult life. So by the time I got home, I made a decision. And the way that I was going to deal with these guys, because remember, at that point, I had the financial wherewithal to hunt them down and, you know, and deal with them, you know, severely. But I went, you know, I got to get rid of this. So it was basically an act of forgiveness. I decided I'm going to turn them all into heroes. So that's how it all started. And when I wrote it, it was a very, very liberating experience. You know, I was casting off all of those demons of my childhood and all that. And when I got done with it, I was very confident. All right, I think I did my job. I think this works, you know. At least I like it, you know. I mean, that's the only thing any writer ever has going for them is do you like it or not? And if you do and you're honest and authentic, which I really sort of tried to be, then you've got the best chance of people seeing your work, seeing it as a movie or whatnot, of identifying with that. And so the answer to the question is, during the production of the movie, no. There's no way to know that it's either going to be well-received or successful or moderately successful and well-received. And then sort of, you know, the holy grail is, are you kidding me? It stood the test of time and it's still here almost 25 years later. And you guys and me, we're on the, you know, Skyping here talking about this. That's impossible to know. But what I did know when we were shooting the movie was that everything was gelling. Okay. All the departments got behind it. The production designer, the director of photography, the first AD, you know, the costume designer, the young actors, everybody understood what was on that page the same way. And they didn't have to endeavor to do it the same way. They just lived it the same way. And that, if that happens, that's as close as you can get to hoping that it will be a success with an audience. And ultimately, the ultimate psychological answer to that question is that, and this is in retrospect, I never thought about this when I was writing it. Dude, when I was writing, I just want to be funny, is that it's Jungian, because everything in that movie is an archetype. You know, there really isn't any, you know, with the possible exception of the night baseball scene, you know, with the red, white, blue fireworks and Ray Charles singing America the Beautiful. There isn't really any other blatant attempt at, you know, trying to catch something from everybody's American psyche. But it happened. And the thing that continues to astound me and will forever is that, for better or for worse, to a lesser degree and a greater degree, almost all of what you see in that movie I'm in it somewhere. And I think that's the greatest thing that any writer can be grateful for, is that they put themselves out there, in other words, on the page, and then ultimately in its final form, in this case, it being a movie, people identified with it. They identified with every one of those characters. You may not have been Benny, but you were probably Squints. If you weren't Squints, you were Bertram. If you weren't Bertram, you were Yaya. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. All that sort of thing. You might not have had parents like that, but somewhere when you were a kid, your parents said something to you that, you know, kind of was like what Scotty's parents say to him. And you may have not have done anything bad. Okay, that's impossible. In your childhood, but you might have done something close to what Scotty did in wanting to be accepted, you know? So that's the only answer I have for that. Was that too long-winded? Sorry about that.
No, that was perfect. It's somewhat of a good segue to my next question, I suppose. Mm-hmm. What I've always been curious about with somebody like you that's created something so important to so many people that's so universally known is, has there ever been a point when you've resented it in a way? Because I think about, like, Roger Waters in Dark Side of the Moon.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like Christopher Plummer in The Sound of Music, or even Harrison Ford to Star Wars to a certain extent until Disney threw a ton of money at him to get back at The Force Awakens, which I love him in.
Right.
And he's brilliant in. I mean, he's fantastic in that. But I've always wondered that about people that just create something so ingenious that just is so touching to so many people around the world.
That is a really, really good question. And I guess my answer is this. No, not essentially. In other words, here's an example of the only time I've ever heard anyone say anything untoward or, you know, a little bit critical. I mean, there's been other critics that say, oh, it's sentimental corn and this and that and the other thing. Those guys are all dead, by the way. yeah. God rest their merry souls. During that 2013, remind me of this question again, Frank, when I get done, because I'm going to forget what that was, but I got a good
answer.
Okay. There's a two-parted answer here. The first answer is this, on a professional level. When we were doing that 2013 20th anniversary tour, in the middle of it, well, about 2 months in, the Utah State Film Commission called me, because that's where we shot the film, in a little town called Glendale within Salt Lake City, Utah, back in 92. And they said, hey, we got all of your original blueprints from the Sandlot, from your from Fox, your productions, I don't know that. We're going to rebuild the Sandlot on the very land that you shot the movie on, because it's the 20th anniversary. And they didn't know anything about the tour. They were just doing this. And Mr. Evans, it would be really cool because we're going to dedicate a Utah State historical marker to you in the film, right? So what am I going to do? Say, dude, I don't have time.
Right.
And so I'm like, duh, I'll be there. Okay, that's awesome. So the original land we shot it on was, I don't know, an acre and a half, 2 acres max. And it was still there, you know, sort of in the middle of this older suburban community and all that. They fixed it all up, got it. And they had, I don't know how many, 1500 or whatever tickets available, and they did a little internet marketing and all that, put it online, and in 11 minutes they sold out. And by the time I got there in, I believe it was July of 2013, 10,000 people showed up from all over the world. Okay. I mean, literally from the Netherlands, from Alaska, from Hawaii, Japan.
This sounds like the end of Field of Dreams.
I swear to you, that's exactly what it was like. That is exactly what it was like. I was there the day before the event was going to happen, walking around with the great Marshall Moore, who was the film commissioner at the time, looking at all the work that these guys had done, and I was astounded. It was exactly like I had left it 20 years earlier. It was amazing. And there were families wandering around the Sandlot field. one of them came up and they had a 9-year-old son, mom and dad and a 9-year-old son. He said, "Are you Mr. Evans?" And I said, "Yeah." Well, we asked Junior, what I can't remember the kid's name, what he wanted to do for his summer vacation. And they were from Anchorage, Alaska. And he could do anything, go to Walt Disney World, Disneyland, anything. And he said he found this online and he wanted to come here. And this is his summer vacation. So you got to know that kid got a pair of PF flyers, a baseball, a poster, a T-shirt. He got everything. Okay. And that was the day before. And then during the day of, like 10,000 people showed up. And, you know, we didn't have the facilities to handle it, but we did our best and this and that. And the governor was there and the senators were there and all this stuff. And we were there from 9 a.m. on a Saturday until, let's say, 5 a.m. the next Sunday. Okay? There were that many people in line. And we were, me and a bunch of the cast members were in the rebuilt dugout signing posters, sort of in an assembly line fashion, being kind to everybody and all that. And of all, let's say, the, it must have been 5,000, 7,000, 8,000 people, one guy, one dad with two young sons, let's call them 4 and 6 or 7 and 9, comes through and I said, "Hey, you know, what's your son's name? Signing it here. This is that and the other thing." And this young man, this young dad says to me, "God, we love this movie so much." I go, "I'm very grateful you do. Thank you so much. I try to be so gracious." And he says, "You know, except for that one word." I said, "Wait, what?" Now, mind you, there's 4,000 people in line behind him, right? And he says, "Well, you know, every time that comes on, we watch the movie, but every time it comes on, my wife or I will grab the remote and turn the volume down." I said, "Sir, I don't know what you're talking about." He says, he leans over to me and he says, "You know, because the word shit is in that movie. So when that word comes on, we turn that down." And I look at this guy, right? And now this is probably the 80,000th autograph I've signed during this tour. And I said, "Really? The word shit offends you?" And he like makes a move to like cover his kid's ears. And I go, "Let me tell you something, you're completely wrong. Because the word shit is not in The Sandlot once. It's in there 3 times.
Yeah.
Okay? And it belongs in there 3 times. And he goes, no. I know. And off he went. Okay. So that was kind of like a, I don't know, they rubbed me the wrong way, you know? It's like whatever the guy's religious or philosophical or proclivities are, I mean, whatever, that's cool. But for God's sake, really? You got to say that? You know? So that was, now, Frank, remind me of what the question was.
The question was, did you ever, at any point in your career, have any resentment towards The Sandlot?
Yeah, that was, I guess that would be a professional moment. And the only other time, it's maybe happened, I don't know, once or twice or whatever, 3 times maybe, in my life since The Sandlot, when there was a personal thing, Facebook, this and that and the other thing. I try to be very, very, very gracious to anybody that loves the movie. I don't want to say my fans. I want to say fans of the movie. And, you know, I'll send a poster if somebody requests a poster or an autograph or whatever. And I'm very, very grateful to do that because I know, look, if it wasn't for those people, I wouldn't have my, you know, my career. And you know what rubs me the wrong way is when you do a favor for someone and then all of a sudden it's like, well, could you do me another one? Because this person that I know that works with me, I would look really good if you gave me another poster to sign for them and stuff. Dude, I just shut that shit down. Unfriend. Bye-bye. Really. Because it's like, I used to like go, well, maybe they just don't really understand what it's like to be sort of, you know, I don't consider myself famous, but I understand I have a modicum of fame when someone knows what I've done, not who I am, what I've done and all that. But dude, when somebody abuses that privilege, and it is a privilege.
Especially, you know, quote unquote, especially for a kid's movie or whatever you want to say, it's very striking and it's evocative and it's awesome. And I just had to ask, how did you get hooked up with, like, the guy who shot multiple movies for Nicholas Rogue.
In the entertainment industry and outside the entertainment industry. We talk, you know, infrequently, but we have a very common deep bond, and it's The Sandlot. Now, if you do just a little bit of digging, you'll find out about Tony. And Tony, first of all, is a Brit, and I love working with Brits, okay? Because Brits, and I don't care what capacity you're working with them on a film, this is my favorite thing about them. It's why, you know, we and they won World War II. They never panic. They just don't panic, you know? Doesn't matter how insidious or pressurized or worry-filled the moment is, and we're never going to get it, and the light's failing, and blah, blah, blah. They never panic. So I met Tony when I was looking for a DP when I was the director of Radio Flyer, picture I wrote and was directing before The Sandlot, before I was ignominiously fired off that show. But that's a whole, dude, that's like another 9-hour interview. A lot of those movies, he did a lot of Nick Rogue movies, you know, he did the Rolling Stones, was it Circus or whatever and all that. Mm-hmm. I mean, Tony was it, you know. I mean, I believe if you look it up, don't quote me, but check it out. I think he was the clapper loader on Dr. Zhivago, okay?
Oh, God.
It's like, are you kidding me, right? So,
yeah, you're
yep, you're right.
Right.
Okay, so.
Clapper loader, uncredited, Dr. Zhivago.
I know.
Fahrenheit 451, clapper loader, uncredited.
Exactly, exactly. My hero author of all time, Ray Bradbury, another 9-hour phone call. Here's the deal. So Tony had a lot of trouble in his life, as we all do. And it was my understanding, and I'm sure he'd tell you the same story if you're interviewing him, and I'll just keep this brief, but I believe that the reason I wanted to meet him, and I interviewed a lot of DPs when I was directing Radio Flyer, was because I had seen The Indian Runner that you guys mentioned. And I loved every frame and the look of that, this washed out semi 60s kind of Kodachromatic, you know, kind of washed out, not a lot of contrast looking stuff. And I said, man, this is what Radio Flyer needs to look like. And so I met him and we got along instantly and famously. And he said to me in that meeting, he says, look, mate, everybody in Hollywood gets a second chance. Nobody gets a third. And I was 27 years old at the time, you know, and I was like, I don't know what the hell you're talking about. And he says, someday you will and all that. And he was looking for a second chance. And I was like, fuck, I don't even know what that means. I want to hire you. I mean, you're a terrific DP and I want my movie to look like that. You know, I got saddled with a particular DP who was given instructions to make sure that I failed miserably and all of that. And then this big conspiracy happened and it's been written about a million times. So when I was eventually fired off Radio Flyer, that was that time I told you in the beginning of this conversation that I was driving up the 405 and had this thing about, oh man, I hit a ball over a fence and those guys, I'll turn them into heroes and all that. And I went home that day. I got home and opened up a new file page and titled the Boys of Summer, which was the original title of The Sandlot, The Boys of Summer. But I couldn't end up using it because,
Don Henley?
No. Roger, the great sports writer, Roger had written, what was the guy's last name? He had written a book called The Boys of Summer, and it was about the Yankees or some shit. Yeah, he threatened to sue us and all that. So we went, oh, okay, well, that's not the title anymore. And like that. But then when the time came around, once the only guy in Hollywood that would hire me not only to purchase The Sandlot, the screenplay, but to allow me and give me the chance to direct it, Mark Berg, who I'm still good friends with. Who do you want to shoot this movie? I said, Tony Richmond. And he said, done. I said, well, you've made a good decision, young Mark. And the reason I wanted him to be like that was still because Radio Flyer was supposed to have been this particular 60s Kodachrome slide, Kodachromatic look. and so was The Sandlot, because it sort of happened in the same, you know, era. And I got to know Tony again. Well, I had known him. The way the look of the film came around was in pre-production. I had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of, you know, those wonderful 60s Kodachrome slides that my mom had given me of me and my brother and cross-country trips and all that. And I took all of those slides and I said, Tony, and I gave him the slides and I said, that's what I want this movie to look like. And that's exactly what he did. I wanted it to look like a faded out, you know, not too high contrasty Kodachrome slide. And he nailed it.
And shot 235, which I love.
There is no question. Anamorphic, 235, you're absolutely correct. And there was a very good reason for that, because we didn't have a lot of time. I had 9 main characters, and I needed to somehow, if necessary, get them all in the frame at the same fucking time. Right?
Yep. Yeah, so it's a really, really, really well shot movie. I mean, obviously, you know, Anthony Richmond, his credits, you know, they speak for themselves. And it's interesting because he's a Brit and he's shooting America's pastime, quote unquote, which also lends a different, you know, angle to it as well. But one of the reasons why, when you go back and, you know, to sort of back to my point earlier, when you watch movies from your youth, 20 years later, one of the reasons why this movie holds up is that it just looks really damn good. Like, it hasn't aged. It doesn't feel dated in any way. Even the really fun scene transitions with the sound effects, you know, that just sort of plays into the whole quaintness of it. And that was one of the things I loved so much about it. Is I go back and I watch these movies, and we've been so conditioned by rapid fire, you know, CGI and editing and just craziness of the last, you know, 10, 15 years. And you go back and watch some of these movies that have a pace like, you know, I reference Joe Dante's work a lot because I love him as a filmmaker, and he really mm-hmm. got that great sense of children. But, like, go back and look at a movie like, you know, The Explorers or something like that. And you wouldn't get a kid's movie made like that these days. Or, you know, Frank brought it up a couple days ago, Indian in the Cupboard. You don't get these great these really well thought out children's films that really appeal to everybody in a unique way without pandering.
You don't.
And so you get it. And this is the thing. And I don't want to. Obviously we'll respect, you know, the situation with Radio Flyer. Obviously anybody can read about it. It sounds like it was just a very tumultuous experience to have. What was it like to sell the Radio Flyer script and the Sandlot script so quickly in terms of your ascension, you know, as a writer? I mean, what is that like, you know, for somebody just starting off in the business?
Life-changing. It's absolutely life-changing. I mean, I've spoken about it before, and it's like, you know, I went to college. I stayed around college for 6.5 years because I had nowhere else to go. And I was a really good student, or at least I knew how to play the politics of being a good student. And after 6.5 years in college and, you know, 4 college degrees and all this, finally had to leave. And, you know, didn't have anywhere to live, lived with my younger brother. I said, hey, man, I just need to live with you for 3 months, you know, that particular summer. 3 years later, I drove away. And in those 3 years, in his back room where I lived and I wrote every single day. And I wrote, and I wrote a novel, which became the screenplay for Radio Flyer. And, you know, knew nobody in the entertainment industry, and somebody read the novel and said, turn it into a screenplay, and I did. And then that somebody gave it to somebody who was an entertainment attorney, who then in turn gave it to somebody who was claiming to be a literary agent, but was really an agent at a child's talent agency, and whose dad had known Richard Donner in the 50s and 60s. And then lo and behold, that screenplay ends up on Richard Donner's desk, and at the same time on Amy Pascal's desk and John Peter's desk and Peter Goober's desk. And that was, you know, November of 1989, and I got a phone call or two. It was like, hey, people are reading your screenplay. And getting a phone call like that when you're destitute is like happy days. You know, it's awesome. What am I going to do? And I went to the bank to withdraw $5 to buy a pack of cigarettes back in the day. I had $5.40 in the bank. And I got there to take my $5 out, and they had charged me my $5 monthly fee. So I had 40 fucking cents in the bank. By the time I walked back to that house, Michael Douglas, like out of nowhere, Michael Douglas, the actor, called me, said, we're going to make your movie. 7 days later, I was a multimillionaire. Do the math.
Yeah. That's just like...
All right.
That's the ultimate, you know, that's like just every aspiring screenwriter's, you know, dream come true story. I mean, I don't know if it gets really any more intense than that.
I don't think so, dude. I don't think it gets any better than that. I mean, I've heard many other stories of sort of rags to riches and stuff. I've heard, you know, I recently read a big interview, loved it, with John Milius in Creative Screenwriting Magazine. You guys probably read it. You know, and he was the USC film guy and met a guy and was still one of my screenwriting heroes. And, you know, he wrote, but it was never one of these big deals, you know, until Apocalypse Now, actually. But mine was literally one day, 40 cents in the bank, 7 days later, multi-millionaire, broke every spec script sale record in Hollywood. And how's that feel? To this day, I cannot verbalize it. I can't.
You know? I can't imagine that you would be able to. And then to have the experience that you did on Video Flyer, and then to get a chance to come back relatively quickly and direct The Sandlot, that also had to have been a rather amazing feeling.
It was terror, sheer unadulterated terror, because I knew that when they dumped me off Radio Flyer as the director, I knew that I would possibly get another chance to direct, but it was only going to be if I wrote something that was contained both in budget, location, time, you know, production time and all that. And I wrote that very, very quickly and found one guy, because by that time the rumor mill on purpose had started with Radio Flyer, and, you know, he can't do this, he can't direct his way out of a paper bag, don't hire him. And that went all through the industry, and nobody wanted anything to do with me except one guy, and that was Mark Byrd. And I'll never forget, he said, let's go to lunch. We went to lunch. And he says, I love this screenplay, this Sandlot, the time, The Boys of Summer. And he goes, and I'm going to buy it and you're going to direct it. And I says, well, wait a minute, you know, because I was offered three, four, five, and six times as much money for that script at all the studios than I had been paid for Radio Flyer, which broke all spec script records. So that was a, you know, an S load of money. But every single one of them said, but you can't direct it. Right? So I said, that's really what I want to do. And he said, I'm going to let you direct it. And I'll never forget this. And I said, well, you know, and this was about a week and a half into the offers. And I said, why? He goes, because I've checked you out. And every single person at every studio, especially Columbia, said you couldn't direct your way out of a paper bag. And I said, so why are you going to let me direct it? He goes, because they can't all be right. And guess what? Mark was right.
Right.
That's awesome because, you know, it always goes to show, it, you know, it's who you know, and it's great to see that somebody was willing to do that, because I'm certainly not in this anywhere near, I'll never be in the position that you were in, so I can't imagine what it must have been like, but something like Radio Flyer, and we should talk about The King of Pacoima, which is the expanded.
Real quick, I want to jump in before we jump into that. I wanted to ask you about Arliss Howard.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yeah.
And this is like a question I've been burning to ask you. I love Arliss Howard. I always have. I mean, I love his entire career. Big Bad Love, I think, is a great film that I don't think enough people have seen.
I agree.
My question to you is this, though. I mean, he comes in at the end, and it's awesome that he's at the end. Mm-hmm. When I was sitting in the theater watching Moneyball,
mm-hmm.
and out of nowhere, Arliss Howard comes in mm-hmm. as what, John Henry, the owner of the Red Sox,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Instantly, in my mind, I thought that this was an amazing homage to The Sandlot.
Well, look, I have no idea if that was the intent, but I mean, will tell you, that is exactly what I thought when I...
Yes!
And I really, really, really like Moneyball. I think it's a great movie. It's not great. Really, it's really... It's incisive. You know, I think it did justice to the book. I think it did, you know? And I loved Pitt and Jonah Hill and all that, and I agree. When he died, I went, oh, man, is that a hit? Is that a heads up? Is that a solid? Maybe. I don't know.
But, I mean, like, come here. I mean, come on. Like, Arliss Howard seems to be very selective of what he does and doesn't do. He hasn't been in a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's by his choosing. And I just thought it was too much of a coincidence for him to show up in Moneyball. Especially since Moneyball was a big awards movie.
It was.
You know, it was supposed to be like, you know, the Social Network of the following year.
That's astute. Yeah, it was supposed to be like that. At least that's the way that it seems that they positioned it. And I don't know. Dude, I mean, you know, I don't, the phone number I have for it probably is before, but maybe.
Bennett Miller is 49 years old, so it stands to reason that, you know, that movie might have been somewhere in his, you know, I don't know what kind of family, that maybe he showed it to his kid. I have no idea, but.
Yeah, I was just curious what you thought about that, because that's something that I have always, that's honestly when I think of Moneyball, that's what I think of with him.
Okay. I appreciate that. My suggestion is this: get Bennett Miller on your show. Okay?
Yeah.
And just point blank, just hit him, ask him. And if
we ever get Bennett Miller on our show, that's going to be my first question.
Dude, ask him that question. Then if he says yes, say, hold on 1 second. Skype me and we'll get on.
That would be epic.
That would be awesome.
It would be.
I'm a very big fan. He's a terrific director.
Same here. I love him.
Yeah, he's very, very, very sharp filmmaker. Foxcatcher, I just absolutely amazing.
How good was Foxcatcher?
Foxcatcher is unfucking believable, if only for the reason that when I was watching that movie, it was already after Steve Carell was getting a ton of buzz,
yep.
and Mark Ruffalo
yep.
was getting a ton of
yep.
buzz, and I'm sitting here watching it with my buddy in the theaters, and it's like 20 minutes in, and I look at him, and I'm like, I didn't know Channing Tatum could act. And to this day, I think that Channing Tatum is the best performance in that film.
Dude, you may be right about that. Look, I am a massive Mark Ruffalo fan.
Same.
Huge Steve Carell fan, especially after that. I mean, my God, dude. And I followed that story back in the day, the DuPont story and all that shit. And God damn, he nailed every nook and cranny and idiosyncratic thing. But Ruffalo, he was as good or better in that movie as he was in Spotlight. You know?
Yeah. Mark Ruffalo is one of my all-time favorite actors.
Same here. Yep.
Just love him. Like, in Zodiac, he's unbelievable. I mean, every movie he's been in, he's just great. And yeah, Foxcatcher's amazing. Channing Tatum did so much, like, physical acting in that movie. Not just the obvious physical acting of the wrestling stuff, but just the way he postured himself and jutted his jaw out, and
yep.
you really got it.
It was like John Wayne style.
Yeah, it is an amazing
yeah.
performance. But getting back to Moneyball, because it's a great baseball movie. What are some of your favorite baseball films? Considering you're such a baseball lover, and besides Moneyball, what do you love?
Oh man, that is such a heavy question. Oh, I mean, Pride of the Yankees, dude. Let's go way back. You know, you know, look, recently, I think you mentioned this a little while ago, 42. The writer-director of that, I was a schoolmate of his in college, Brian Helgeland. Absolutely one of the best, definitely one of the best screenwriters of the last 30 years. I mean, there's no question.
Yeah.
You know, he really is. He's in, and I admire his work. You know, if I had to, if you say, pick one, and it can't be one of your movies. Okay, cool. If I literally, if I had to pick one, I mean, I bawl my eyes out every time I watch Field of Dreams. I literally bawl my eyes out every time I watch The Natural.
Yes,
based on a true story. Based on a true story, okay? You know, that crazy woman that followed, his name wasn't Roy Hobbs, it was something else. But if I have to pick one, if you're like, dude, the guillotine's coming down, pick one. It's got to be the Bad News Bears, dude.
Yeah, that's
I love The Rookie. I love 42.
You're killing me.
I love 61. I love, you know, I love baseball movies. I love it. And Field of Dreams. I mean, I hate, you know, it's like a razor's edge. But Buttermaker, Tatum O'Neill, all those guys. And I think it was Bill Lancaster was the screenwriter, was it not? Check me out there, someone on IMDb.
I'm looking it up right
now. Try today. To get that screenplay financed with that kind of verbiage in it.
Yeah, the Bad News.
That guy also wrote The Thing.
He did, yeah, Bill Lancaster, right?
Yeah. So,
and I think, you know, all movies considered, one of Matthau's finest performances, and I literally lived in that section of the San Fernando Valley where they shot that movie in those early 70s years. You know, maybe it was 74, 75, 76. But everything that it deals with, you know, you got your racism, your exclusionary thing, your bully stuff, your daddy ball bullshit with Vic Morrow, right? Your star kid who's like, you know, a rebel, you know, and butter and all. It's, I mean, I just took a gig just a little while ago where I'm going to write and direct the story of these two young kids, 14, 15 years old in 2012, Christopher Puckett and Cameron Shelley in San Clemente, California, where they ended up being the very first official coaches of a little league team that were not adults. And they were supposed to fail miserably, and they ended up winning a state championship.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And my reference for that is two movies. What? But especially Bad News Bears. Because what I've learned through all this research with them is, you know what? Parents haven't changed, dude. It's still horrible. You know? It's like,
yeah.
It isn't about winning at that age, people. You know? It's about learning, sharpening your skills, participating, and all that. And I'm not saying I'm a believer and everybody should get a fucking trophy. No! I don't think it, you know, no! If you win, you get a trophy. If you don't, hey, be happy you completed. But I'd have to say the Bad News Bears, really.
Yeah, that's at the top of my list as well. Bad News Bears came up on our baseball podcast we just did, and it's amazing. I mean, I was born in 1980, so that movie for me was something that I watched repeatedly on HBO and on the cable stations when I was 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. And it made an immediate impact. I didn't know anything about movies, obviously, but I knew I was watching a different type of – and I didn't know anything about 70s filmmaking back then or who Michael Ritchie was or, you know, Bill Lancaster or Walter Matthau. But there was something different about the Bad News Bears than when I watched the other stuff that was made in the 80s, like, directly for me. But I was able to relate to it still because it was about kids. But I knew in the back of my head that it was still adult. And that's one of the things I love so much. I mean, I've seen the movie 50 times throughout the years. I mean, I couldn't even put a number on it. I just think it's so sharp, and the satire is there in a very unforced way. And that's that sort of categorizes most of Michael Ritchie's works. Just a really underrated director. But yeah, Bad News Bears is certainly one of my favorites. And you mentioned The Rookie. God, I love The Rookie. I mean, like, that movie just that – I mean, I had tears in my eyes when he ran out to the mound. And I just thought that movie captured a great sense of Americana without being, like, jingoistic. And this, the baseball footage is fantastic in it. And obviously Dennis Quaid gave one of his best performances. He should have been nominated for an Oscar.
There's no question. And my thing about a movie is this. I'll stick with it. You know, it doesn't have to, like, you know, hook me and beat me over the head and make me pay attention. If it's like, okay, well, I'm paying attention, that's fine. And then, dude, in the end, right, it wasn't when he ran out on that, which he only had one take with that Steadicam guy who should have got the...
It's so awesome.
He should have got the Academy Award for Technical Excellence in that year.
It's but incredible.
It's when... The Dennis Quaid, the Jim, whatever the guy's name was, Jim. When Dennis Quaid, after that, meets his dad, and his dad, after his entire life, shows up to tell him he's proud of him. I'm going to break down in tears.
Yeah, Brian Cox, absolutely.
Yeah, Brian Cox, one of my all-time favorite characters.
Just could never be bad if he tried. The guy is an amazing actor. One of our, one of Frank and our favorite actors to, you know, watch.
Guy wouldn't give his son the time of day after all we've seen that character has been through. But, and this is the best thing that movie does, and I think the best thing any movie does, is that it carried us along with their story and their journey. You identify with him. You want what that character wants from those other characters that aren't giving it to him, her, us. And then in the end, you're given this release, which is very, very, very human. It's like, how long is that leather-necked, you know, Navy admiral, whatever the hell his designation was, how long is he going to deny his own love of his own son? And, well... it's to right here, and then he does. Oh God! Are you guys still there?
Yeah, no, I'm here.
No, it's.
I was in the moment with you.
it's such a great film, and before I know we want to be mindful of our time. We're getting close to our hour, but I want to bring up the King of Pacoima because you know, just to bring it back to Radio Flyer for a second. When I was a kid, you know, when I was 10, 11, 12, when that movie came out, I didn't know anything about, you know, the back behind the scenes problems and people getting fired and stuff. You know, that movie captured my imagination when I was a kid. I didn't know anything about any of that stuff. Reading the book just recently was very intense because the book clearly serves as the inspiration for what was shot, you know, what became the movie, but it's so much more and it's so different in so many key aspects. And,
guys, sorry about that. Are you there?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're here.
Oh man. I just got cut off for like 2 minutes. Wow. Sorry.
No, it's all good. Nick, just repeat what you were saying.
No worries. No, I just wanted to bring up King of Pacoima because, sure. it really, you know, transitions from Radio Flyer, which did make an impact on me as a child. But the book is so intense. How did you get back into that story? Especially after the intensity of that production, you went back to the book.
Okay. Great question. The deal is this. I'd always had the novel because I wrote the novel in, I think, 1987 and 88. I sent it out to like 26 or 30 publishers, got turned down every time. And then I think I mentioned earlier, I sent it to a friend and he said, turn it into a screenplay and blah, blah, blah. Well, after the movie got made and it had all the hoopla and all that, and let's say 25 years later, you know, I'd started my blog and all the social media presence and all that, but specifically my blog. And after 250,000, more than a quarter of a million page views, I'd say 60% of them were on a particular article called "What Happened to Bobby at the End of Radio Flyer?" You know?
Yeah.
Right? Where I'd done an interview with Stephen Greenfield, great journalist friend of mine back in the day, and I answered all those questions, but still the questions kept coming, you know? Like, well, if that, this, and if you said that, well, what about this? And so one day, I guess about 3 years ago, I said, I got to put this shit to rest. So I got out the original manuscript and I, you know, fixed it up and included a lot of photographs and artwork and such, and said, I'm just going to publish it. And anytime anybody asks me that question, what happened to Bobby at the end of Radio Flyer, and I'll read this book. So I don't have to answer that question anymore. There you go.
The book feels staggeringly personal at times.
It is, dude. It really is. It's an act of contrition on my part, to a certain extent. It's also what I meant. And, you know, it's, you know, 70-30, 70 me, 30 made up. But it's close enough, and it's I think it's important.
I didn't want to ask just because it's a sensitive subject, but like, so the material in the book is sort of inspired by your life to a certain degree?
Yes, to a greater degree.
Wow. Okay. Well, it makes it even more interesting.
Nick, let me put it this way. Nick and Frank, people have asked me that before. I mean, and a bunch of people have asked me on Amazon. You can buy it on Amazon. You can buy it on CrateSpace. Or you can go to my publishing website, flyingwagonbooks.com, and you can get it there. And I've got a lot of questions like, how much of this is you, blah, blah, blah. And my the only way I can answer that, you know, in a kind way, in a gracious way, is this. Read that book, and that was my childhood light.
Hmm.
Think about that.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Because, yeah, again, you know.
We're going to put the link up for that when we publish.
I would appreciate that, guys. That's quite awesome.
Absolutely.
Because I've got, you know, some sixth grade, not any really grades lower than that. Many sixth grade teachers across the country. Definitely many, middle school, 7th, 8th, and 9th, or 8th, 9th grade teachers, and a whole lot of 10th and 11th grade English teachers, some social studies teachers, have bought a lot of copies of that book and are using it as a springboard for discussion, and especially with the way it is today with bullying and social media and all that kind of stuff. In my day, a bully was somebody just punched you right in the face. Believe it or not, my wife's mother is a psychiatrist and psychologist who works in a state jail here where we are. And she uses that book and the movie and has helped. And this is insanely, I am insanely grateful for this. For people, you know, kids, young people in their 20s, whatever, or even repeat offenders that come in, she shows them that movie and gives them copies of that book. And invariably, in the hundreds and hundreds of times she's done that, they come back in tears and say, that's my life. That's why I ended up here, you know. And then she uses that as an icebreaker and is able to help them, and they never come back to jail. So I guess it did some good, you know.
That's awesome, man. Wow.
Well, don't mean to end this on such a sour note.
Yeah. What the fuck happened about the Sandlot?
Let me tell you an Irish joke. Yeah. but look.
Well, I guess we should also really, really quickly ask, because I know that you said that you would – you're working on something new, so there's a couple of new projects that are in the works right now for you?
Yes, sir. I recently, after it took me a long – this is something that is taking me the longest to write of anything ever. And I'm actually attached to write – I've already written it – to direct the story of Coach Ed Thomas from Parkersburg, Iowa.
Yeah.
And you guys remember his story in 2008 and 2009?
I don't think I'm familiar. You mentioned it earlier in the cast, but
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, his the name of the movie is The Sacred Acre. There was a sort of not such a great biography. It was more of a chronology of a book written about him after he was deceased in 2009. But essentially it's this, long story short, arguably the greatest high school football coach that ever lived. Small town Iowa, Parkersburg, spends 33 years there, molding minds, turning down any kid that wanted to play football in a K through 12 that really only had 250 people, kids, students, but always managed to field a team of 75 players. How do you do that? And also, in that time, sent four of them to the NFL, okay? Touched and influenced in a positive fashion tens of thousands of young people through his career. And have this great football field and complex that people nicknamed the Sacred Acre because he was so sort of, particular about it. And in 2008, an E5 tornado goes through, destroys everything. He rebuilds it in time in a miracle, sort of a Hail Mary pass. Rebuilds it in time for the seniors to play their home opener that year. And then the next year, a former student who was a paranoid schizophrenic murdered him in front of 250 kids. It's a story of redemption, a story of forgiveness, and a very, very, very intentionally faith-based movie, and we're going to shoot that this year. And then the other one is the Little League movie I mentioned about Chris Puckett and Cameron Shelley in San Clemente, California. And then I've got one more, which depending on how those two go, might be before or after, which is something called Hemingway's Hero, which I have my great friend Peter Fonda, who has agreed to star in it. So I got a full plate, boys.
Wow.
Oh, that's awesome. You're more than welcome anytime to come back and hype up any of these projects or talk about anything else. That would be fantastic.
Cool. Is 9 a.m. tomorrow good?
That works. All right. I'll call in sick tomorrow.
Awesome. guys, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate, and I'm very, very grateful for you, listen to me rant.
No, man, this was incredible. Thank you so very much for coming on and talking to us. This has been our
well. Listen, yeah, we absolutely. We should make this like a 10-parter. Each one should be an hour, and you can put them on the internet, and we'll tell film schools that they can have it for $1,000 a pop.
I think that's one of the best ideas I've ever heard in my entire life.
Well, I was only half kidding, Frank.
Well, whatever.
Stop! No, go get a ball, Jesus. The cap that if I had a phone I could Maverick. It's like get a German Shepherd. They said you'll never be alone. They said you'll love it.
Thank you very 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 much for coming on, and certainly we will be keeping in touch, and would love to have you back on and talk anything else, and anything your projects, favorite movies, whatever you like. It was a real treat,
dude. Back at you. I'm very grateful. Thank you very very much, Nick and Frank. Anytime, man. And you know what? You might regret what you just told me. Okay. See you guys soon.
You bet.
Thanks again. Maverick, leave me alone. All right. Bye, guys.